This is the predicament I'm in these days. Sometimes it gets real tough, but we find a way.
77 Jefferson has been around since 2006, and they're one of the few local acts performing in a reggae festival in the Crossroads later this month. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today we're starting the show here on KCUR's Central Standard by getting to know one of the founders of the band, Miles Brown. Hi, Miles.
Hi, Gina.
Tell me about this song.
This song is These Days. We released this in 2009, I believe. Just shortly after we kind of got started, our second full length features our good friend Josh Heinrichs, and this song kind of helped push us in our direction for quite a few years to come.
What's reggae about it, and where does the alt part come in?
What's reggae about it? Well, musically, you know, you hear the guitar parts, the wah, the skank, as we call it. It kind of helps form what people know as reggae. The message, you know, love, trials, tribulation, being a little direct, not so abstract in our lyrics. Yeah, that's just my opinion on it, but that's kind of how we've taken it.
And what about the alt part?
Well, alt, kind of like, all right, say we listen to 101 The Fox. We're listening to classic rock there, you know, or you switch it to 96.5 The Buzz and you're listening to alternative rock. So I guess that's just our way of maybe defining the progression of the genre, perhaps. A lot of people think of reggae, they think of, you know, Red, Gold, and Green or Rasta this or that. And we've kind of taken it, like a lot of other groups have, the genre, moving it away from maybe that stigma or that stereotype, perhaps.
You see that as a negative thing?
In my opinion, it's like separation of church and state. You know, Rasta is a religion. You know, not everybody's bound to that. And
it's sacred to some people, so if you take the church and state analogy, it would be sacrilegious from some standpoints to be altering it if you didn't separate yourself somehow, maybe?
Sure, sure. Now, there are people out there that, you know, older artists and Jamaican artists that probably don't like the progression of the genre. But, you know, music is music, and as time goes, all genres mend and kind of fuse together over time, and we've seen quite a bit of that over the past decade for reggae. So,
how did you get into reggae?
You know, for me as a kid, you know, the obvious things like Bob Marley. Now, there were bands that kind of set the tone for bands like us, say like Sublime, 311, Fishbone.
That would be like what, mid-90s?
Mid-90s, late-90s, yeah, yeah.
Describe those bands for people who aren't familiar.
You know, let's see, like 311, they have a rocky, you know, a little more rock. There's heavy guitar and stuff back there, but they also have
very poppy.
A little poppy, yep, yep. Lots of harmonies. You know, the guitar skanks that we were telling you about, that it almost defines the sound, like they're, it's like, oh, it's reggae-ish. Right? But with 311 also, they were very direct vocally. Again, not a lot of abstract lyrics. We've got a message. We're going to put it down, wear it on our sleeve. And I think for the listeners, you know, maybe that's something that they want, something that they need. They have...
But who are you as a listener when you're hearing this? I mean, take me back to you being influenced by this stuff.
Take me back. That was a while back. Yeah, the directness, the moral compass of what's right and just, that kind of thing always turned me on to music.
How old were you at this time?
You know, this was, man, I was maybe 10, maybe a little earlier when I got a hold of some Bob Marley, and now I got into hip hop as well, and they share kind of a common, at least older hip hop shares that directness. From where it was grown, lyrically. So I find myself leaning towards these genres that have more to do with life than just music, or is a lot easier, a more cut and dry message, I suppose, easy for people to understand and maybe jump on the boat for some type of activism or just to do what's right.
So the politics of reggae mattered to you from the beginning?
I think so, yeah. And that might have been more clear to me later in life. But yeah, I think it always was.
What would you say are the politics of reggae?
Well, I think in general, we might have a liberal listening base. But it may be not so much the politics, but more about the moral compass of it. But that's not always been the case. You know, if you go back to Jamaican reggae and stuff, maybe they're not too keen on homosexuality and things like that. And that is where kind of, I think, things have changed. You know, times have changed and the musicians have changed and we kind of set our own rules, if you will, as far as the guidelines of what's acceptable, what we feel is right, what we feel is just. So maybe just leading by the heart. And, you know, for me, if I'm looking at politics, if I'm looking at politicians, that's probably the first thing I'd like to do is look at their heart. Are they good there? And then let's talk about policy. But, yeah.
Yesterday, I heard Bob Marley's son, Ziggy Marley, on one of the national shows we carry, and the interviewer asked him about the politics of reggae and whether he thought that people listening to Bob Marley today at, like, happy hours or whatever had any idea that these songs were political. And his answer was pretty interesting. He said that the songs have a vibe you can get into no matter what. So, like, if a bunch of bros, forgive my terminology, hear Bob Marley at a barbecue, they're just bopping along to these tunes, feeling good, not thinking about politics. But then maybe they listen to the album later in the car or whatever and start to hear the message. And that makes sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk to me about, you know, you're a person who has grown up listening to this stuff and mm-hmm. then ended up starting a reggae band yourself. And I wonder if that's kind of a progression you've been on.
Yeah, you know, the vibe that he's talking about, I think it's the feeling that it brings musically. You know, if you want to break it down, you can talk about, major chords and a happy feeling from that. But yeah, I think that it's a non-invasive form of music. It's a non-invasive sound that people can kind of just jive with naturally and, not be bogged down by negative thoughts. It's interesting that it does that kind of maybe subconsciously. And then, yeah, right, if you take a moment and then listen to the words and you get the message out of it and it goes a little bit deeper, that almost ignites you to do something about it. So, yeah, It's a beautiful genre, and, I'm lucky to have spent the time that I have with it.
Tell me about starting 77 Jefferson. When did you start that band?
We started in 2006. Me and my singer, Joel Castillo, are the two original members that are left. We started on jamming in a house on 77th and Jefferson out in Waldo. And, that was, heck, almost 11 years ago now, so we weren't exactly sure what we were going to be when we started, but Joel, you know, we a lot of us listened to a handful of reggae, and then all of a sudden we had these original tunes that were in a, you know, slight reggae fashion. So we're like, okay, let's move with this. We like this, and here we are.
What was Kansas City's reggae scene like in 2006?
Very small. In the 80s we had bands like Blue Rhythm that kind of started things out for us, and there's some fantastic footage of them jamming in Jamaica overnight at one of their biggest festivals, Sunsplash, I believe. And fast forward a couple decades, and 2006, us starting there wasn't many groups. But, you know, after we played our first show, just like that, there were a couple new reggae bands in town. Seed Love, New Rhythm started popping out. So, yeah, all of a sudden, there, a couple of years later, we had 5, 6, 10 reggae bands that were booking shows and playing and kind of starting this little scene. And
who is the audience in this scene? Because, I mean, I hope you don't mind my saying so. You are a white guy.
Uh-huh.
And reggae historically, you know, comes from Jamaica in the late 1960s. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, that's fine. I'm just curious if Kansas City's reggae scene, does it look like you?
It's a little mixed now. Back when we first started, you know, once a local reggae scene started going on, the promoters, you know, the lights turned on and they wanted to bring in some, you know, other reggae artists. Naturally, these were some Jamaican artists and stuff. So we had the opportunity to perform, you know, open up for big Jamaican artists. And those crowds were mixed. And we could tell that the audience, the mix of the audience, some people weren't sure what to think of us white boy reggae band. And, you know, over time, we worked to try to close that gap a little bit. So, yeah, our shows now, it's a mix. And, yeah, I think we drew from like-minded people like us. Also, you know, I think the jam band crowd tends to favor that sound. And, yeah, and, you know, we still have those people that we saw that really dug the Jamaican artists and that dig the Jamaican reggae. They still come out to our shows too, but you know, hell, I don't know if I should give a ratio on what color our crowd is, but I would just say it's kind of mixed. Yeah.
But is it kind of hard to let a genre evolve when it's so closely associated with a specific time and place in history? I mean, in this case, Jamaica in the late 60s, I imagine that there are purists out there, not to mention people who are into a certain fashion or lifestyle associated with all of that.
Yeah, definitely. There are the purists, and there are people that won't want the genre to progress. Interesting enough, I was just in California. We started filming me and my buddy Josh Heinrichs, who is also a big name in the reggae scene internationally. We started a documentary idea and went out to the One Love Festival out in California to talk about this genre and what it means to people and how it's reaching people like us here in the middle of the United States.
Midwesterners.
Yeah, Midwesterners. And so we got to talk to some of the older artists, some of the artists that were there to start the genre. And now they're playing, you know, opening up rather for headliners that are these white American reggae bands and to get their take on it. And it was really interesting. You know, one of the original members from Fishbone, we were interviewing him and he was saying, listen, all genres, if they are to grow, if they're to do what time wants it to do, at some point they're going to be unrecognizable. He said, if you were to hand Chuck Berry a Metallica CD or something like that and say, hey, you did this, you know, would he believe you? No, probably not. But that's just been the progression of rock and roll. And yeah, the sanctity of reggae, you can trace it back to almost every genre. Like, oh, rock and roll in the, you know, in the 50s, the 60s, and, you know, this was rock and roll, and whatever it is today is not. Well, you know, it's going to change. So for better, for worse, you know, we love, we respect what it was. You know, give thanks to that because it started what we have now. But yeah, I think just like every genre that's going to be successful has to progress a little bit.
What will happen with the interviews that you did out in California?
Eventually, we're going to have to do some more traveling and we hope to maybe go abroad. There's some talks about linking up on some tours out in Europe, maybe trying to get a more worldly perspective on it. And
is this for like a documentary?
Yeah, just an idea that we had. I do a lot of film and stuff too. And, you know, any good opportunity we have or I have to to utilize my fun cameras and you know, do something that I think is right and just, then I'm on board. So hopefully we get it put together and come in here in the next year or so.
Well, we're listening to another song now. This will take us out. The song is called Rocksteady, which is a term with its own meaning and its own history. It's a term you hear in a lot of song lyrics. Can you tell me about the phrase Rocksteady?
You know, through reggae, there's been a handful of different subgenres, whether it's dancehall, rocksteady, you know, roots rock, lovers rock. So this for us, and we might have redefined it a little bit just for this song purpose, but
that happens with this phrase in songs.
Yeah, it happens with most phrases.
Like steady happens, rocking all night long.
Right, precisely. So this one, we just wanted to have fun with it, and for us, for this song, Rocksteady, we're just talking about having a good time, dancing, and being with the ones we love.
So, you know, you are working on a new album, and before we go, I just want to ask you what people should expect from that album and when they should expect to hear it.
Well, for any 77 fans out there listening, like to announce that, yeah, we will have a new album coming out, and it will be available on July 7th, 7/7, 2017. So pre-orders will be up soon. And what you can expect is a lot of the same that we've done. You know, me and my partner Joel Castillo, we do a lot of the writing for the group. Of course, we have our members that just slay it for us live on the stage. But Joel and I putting together some kind of island vibe songs, mixing it up a little bit. Should have about, I don't know. Should have about six songs here coming for you soon.
Miles Brown of 77 Jefferson, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
77 Jefferson is on the lineup for the Crossroads Jammin' Reggae Fest on June 24th. We're off to a quick break. When Central Standard returns, the artist known as Boy Boy has a show opening at First Friday tonight. Stay tuned. Rocksteady with you, girl. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, here with the artist known as Boy Boy. That's B-O-I-B-O-Y. If you're headed to First Friday and the Crossroads tonight, you can catch the opening of their new show at the Front Space. It's called Select Username and Password. Boy Boy, good morning.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Pretty good. Acceptable, but great.
I was thinking you must be running on adrenaline with a big show opening just hours from now.
I'm consistently running on adrenaline.
Oh, so that's just your...
Oh, yeah, it's my common stasis.
Why?
Because I like to stay super, super busy. I go insane if I'm not working on something all the time. Like, sitting and, like, not doing anything stresses me out more than a gratuitous amount of projects going on.
So when I feel like just sitting, I should call you and be like, hey.
What's up? Yeah.
You want to do some stuff?
Let's build some things. It'll be great.
Tell me about your new show.
So it is a collaboration between me and Blair Shulman, and it's actually his idea, and it's been floating around his head for a long time. And we went through a lot of different phases to try and figure out the best means to talk about it. So it's about cruising and, like, the history of cruising and, like, how it applies to the queer community. And so...
So, yeah, explain that term.
Cruising. So cruising is how you would find a sexual partner. And especially for the queer community, like, pre-gay bars or especially pre, digital, you would go and seek these out in different locations. And it was often maybe a little bit skeevy at times, but... also provided a sense of community because you were gathering at, like, Liberty Memorial was, like, this classic cruising site for Kansas City. So, and then for me, I'm really fascinated by the hanky code, which was a form of flagging. So it would be how you would signal to another person that you were another gay individual and then, like, what you were looking for. So there's a elaborate color code of hankies that would then suggest your sexual desire at any given point.
So select username and password seems like such an explicit reference to a digital kind of code.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting to me that your fascination is so much with code as implemented to, you know, connect with other people.
Yeah.
Before that was a thing.
I think it's just trying to draw a connection between the two of, like, different means in which we find it, and then kind of talking about the effects of basically online dating sites or dating apps, where it becomes very based off of, I don't want to say, what's the best way to say it? It's very easy to, like, ignore somebody or to become prejudiced or to not become an active part of the community versus, like, if you're meeting in person or there's this kind of signal that you're another queer person existing in the world, it's easier to, even if it's not based off of, like, a sexual ending, you can build this community that becomes about discussion or other forms of. So I think that it's.
I feel like I'm hearing kind of a nostalgia from you for a time when that maybe I'm not. I guess, like, the idea that you're signaling with something like a hanky, part of that is because of a danger in signaling something more overtly.
Exactly.
It's interesting to me that you, as this seemingly young person, would feel a kind of nostalgia or longing for something like that.
I think it's just important to understand your history, especially, like, as a queer person, and especially now that it is Pride Month, is kind of taking a time to look back at, like, how we got to where we are and what does that mean and what do we still need to work on and how does that affect our community. And I think my whole point of, like, and I really want to bring back the hanky code because it's taking us out of the digital closet. It's forcing us into a world where we can, and it's more or less, it's not always used as a means to an end, but just like a tongue-in-cheek signifier. Like, some of the, so they ran out of color codes, or, like, the amount of colors. It's a very extensive list. So my two favorites are, like, if you have a teddy bear in your back pocket, it means you just like to cuddle. Or if you, my favorite is if you have a, like, piece of celery, means you're either looking for brunch or willing to host brunch. So it becomes this.
Celery is like a reference to a Bloody Mary or something?
I guess. Yeah. So I think that it forces us to, like, not forces us, but it becomes like this weird inside joke but in the queer community to, like, oh, I see you in the grocery store. I see your hanky. We're on the same page, even though nobody else can realize it. And, like,
so, like, recognizability in the real world.
Yeah. And then just, like, how we as queer people, like, exist in a very, like, hetero world and how we can kind of expand what our community spaces are into, like, the full community.
So you just used a phrase that is super interesting to me, the digital closet. Do you feel like there is a digital closet?
I think that there's something comfortable about how we seek out relationships based off of, and I'm definitely guilty of it. I love those apps. They're fun.
What apps are you talking about?
So there's, like, Grindr, there's Scruff, there's Jacked, there's OkCupid, there's Tinder, there's Craigslist.
Apps that allow you to meet other people?
Yeah. Basically hookup apps, for lack of a better term. I'm trying to keep this as semi-professional when talking about random sexual hookups. And I think those have, like, a time and a place, and they're great. But then I think that we can also challenge ourselves to go beyond that and to come out of that and to...
What is a closet about it?
I think that it provides... Like, you can hide behind it. You can hide within that, like, persona of who you are representing yourself in a digital form. Like, you can... create the illusion of who you want to be versus, like, you in a physical sense, like, you are truly yourself. Even if you're, like your mannerisms, your way of expressing your emotions, your vocabulary, your even just, like, your vibes. Like, there's a lot of things to, like, being in a physical space with somebody versus being in, like, judging them based off of that one selfie they took when the lighting was perfect.
That you're spontaneous and physical?
Mm-hmm. I think that there's also just, like, a different level of courage that it takes to exist in, like, the physical space, versus it can be easier to message people or to kind of hide behind something or to be inappropriate or to be very problematic on some of these sites too. That is not something you would do in real life.
That, like, when I was thinking about the idea of code, I was really thinking about it in terms of, I don't know, algorithms and things like that in the digital sense. And when you talk about code in reference to the hanky code,
yeah,
that's very different. And I thought maybe that I was going to hear a sense of continuity between these two things from you, but I actually hear exactly the opposite, just that these are two very different ways of existing in the world and finding other people.
Yeah, and I think that the hanky code has transferred into the digital sense, but it's like a bio based, where it's like, what are you into? What is your like sexual position? What is your so it's changed from, and there's some things that's like still exist, like on the dating sites where it's like, what tribe do you identify? Where it's like bear or cub or, so I think they're
jargon for
basically,
yeah.
So I think there is some sort of transfer of that code system, but I think that the hanky code is almost kind of a lost language in some sense, and trying to bring it back into a physical space, I think, is nice.
Tell me more about yourself and your background.
Oh, gosh. So I'm originally from Kansas City. I grew up in Brookside, and then I went to Catholic grade school and high school, which is always fun. And then went to the Art Institute, and I graduated last year. That's how time works. And I graduated from Fiber, and this past year I have been in the Charlotte Street Foundation studio residency, which has been phenomenal.
What kind of stuff have you been working on? Because I feel like we've heard so much about the ideas in your current show, but I'm not sure what to picture.
Oh, I mostly do installation-based design, so it's I do a little bit of everything. It's more exciting that way. So it's like for the show at Front Space, I built a forest scene or park scene where it's like where you would go cruising. So there's like a giant 9-foot by 36-foot landscape painting that I did. And then there's like a whole bunch of fake foliage. And then the grass is all dyed wool rug. So it creates like the illusion. And there's going to be like smell of fresh cut grass. And then there's like a weird bathroom scene that's like I papier-mâché'd a giant toilet and a weird sink and painted tile. So it's for me, it's my studio practice is like creating these installations, these other worlds that kind of separate us a little bit from reality and create this fantasy.
So when people who have maybe never been part of the kind of cruising scenarios
yeah.
you're talking about, when they are in this space you've created where they have a lot of the, you know, I don't know, like the sensory signals of
yeah.
being in that space. What do you want them to get?
I think half of it's like a little tongue in cheek where it's like we're pointing out the absurdity of this, of how we seek out sex. And then I think leaving with a sense of kind of contemplating how we seek out a sexual partner. And this goes for like gay and straight and everything in between. How we seek out sexual partners and what effect that has on us and on other people. And, but also encouraging like a sex positive approach to it at the same time, where it's just like, we need to be considerate about how we represent ourselves and how we treat other people and how we exist and how we be sexually active, in a way that's respectful to ourselves and to other people, but then can play into a lot of other things.
When did you take on the name Boy Boy?
Oh, gosh. Like 4 years ago-ish?
What does it mean?
What do you mean? What does it mean? I honestly don't remember what the origin story of it is anymore. Like, I really wish I had, like, oh, it came to me and this is exactly what it's like. But I think it just, like, popped into my head and I was like, this makes sense to me. I need to... like, it felt comfortable.
It just felt like your name?
Yeah. Like, and I think it's playing on, like, the masculine and feminine or more gender neutral, even though it is boy, like B-O-I, B-O-Y, but B-O-I is more, like, effeminate male or masculine female. Like, it plays on kind of these both of these things. And as I exist in the world and kind of can, for me personally, like, fluctuate between and kind of explore that as well.
The space where you're having the show that's opening tonight,
mm-hmm.
I understand that that's of particular importance to you. Can you talk about that?
Front Space?
Mm-hmm.
What do you...
Well, I guess I just understand that there's a certain... I don't know, that you prefer kind of DIY
oh, yeah.
spaces.
So, and Front Space has like is a really, really spectacular space. And I think that... there is a lot of significance to DIY and artist-run spaces, and they have like the ability where it's like this show couldn't necessarily function in a traditional white wall gallery space. Like it's not sellable work. It's not marketable. It's not that. It's like we're trying to create an experience or this kind of beautiful moment for people, and DIY and artist-run spaces have the ability to be more experimental with their programming and what they show, which is really great for people like me who don't do necessarily sellable, quote unquote, work. It's like it's about creating the installation, the environment, this experience for people. So
why is that important to you? I mean, I guess, is there a kind of space that you feel needs to be created for, you know, like your particular shows that maybe just doesn't exist out there in the world?
I think so. I also am really fascinated by like the crossover between how we interact with spaces. So it's like for a lot of my work, I also do like my is thinking about how like we as queer people exist in a space and how like club culture becomes this community space for us. So how we can build a crossover between like a club culture or going out and like the art community. So how artists can build this environment that becomes more experiential. And then there's also a different durational control of your audience as like they will interact with the space a little bit longer. And it also takes away some of the stigma where it's like, if you're not a part of the art community and it's not First Fridays or something like that, it's hard to walk into a white wall gallery where you don't know anyone or like you don't know how to interact with those spaces. So if you change the context of how people interact with it, you can, make it a little bit more exciting and interactive and kind of change people's perspective of what they think art is or how they can interact with it.
What are you most excited about for tonight? Tonight will be the beginning of people being a part of Select Username Password.
I mean, I'm excited to see how people react to it. I think it should be good. I think that I'm interested to see how people will kind of take it and what conversations and like how they react, whether they think it's serious or funny or because it's trying to balance a little bit of both. And hopefully it gets them thinking. And then it's there's also an event after that's Electrosexual, which is a queer dance party. So we're partnering. So the opening of Select New Username and Password is at Front Space. And then tonight there's a queer dance party called Electrosexual at the Bat Cave. And then tomorrow there's going to be a lecture and workshop about the Hanky Code at Plug Project. So we're trying to make this like a full weekend as we kick off Pride and make it very exciting and interactive and getting as many people involved.
Boy, thanks so much for sharing your story with us, and I'll let you get back to preparing for tonight's show.
Yeah, all the fun stuff.
Select Username and Password opens tonight in the Front Space as part of First Fridays in the Crossroads. Check it out. Next up, connecting the old-fashioned way with a pen and paper on KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, back in a minute. We're back with one more artsy thing to get your summer started on KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, joined now by Meredith Moore, who runs an art space and stationery store in Lawrence called Wonder Fair, where they host a monthly letter writing club. This month's get-together will take place on June 18th. Hi, Meredith.
Hi, Gina.
So if you out there want to give us a call at 816-235-2888, you can tell us about your personal take on letter writing. Does it matter to you? Or do texting and social media get the job done? We'd also love to hear about the best letter you ever got at 816-235-2888, but call fast so we can get you in before the show is over. Meredith, when did you start this letter writing club?
Letter Writing Club was founded formally in 2014. I believe October of 2014. So we've been meeting well into 2.5 years now. I think we are official.
Why did you start it?
Well, if I'm being very honest, I think it's because my mother had passed away and I was sad, as one might anticipate. But I kept reflecting through the year that passed on a letter that someone had written me that was really helpful in that time, and I was increasingly frustrated with Facebook and other forms of social media that I was in my professional life having to engage with quite a bit. And so I really wanted my private life to become more intimate and to have more opportunities to reach out to my friends and family in a way that was not online. So I thought, what's a club?
What's different about doing it not online?
Well, primarily, I would address again that I think so much of our interaction online is mediated through Facebook. And as our content and the things we share with our loved ones is shared with advertisers, I think one can't always help but feel a little bit, what is the correct word? Manipulated in those relationships. And I think that if I'm going to be manipulating something, I want it to be with my hands. I want to be holding the paper, the pen, the adorable stickers. As children, many of us wrote letters, and that was the primary way I engaged with my friends as a young girl. So dating myself, which is crazy because I am very young, but technology is going so fast, and I like I
that generations are like
down.
2 years long.
Yes, they are. So I, we have to slow it down.
How old are you?
So much today. I'm 33. I'm Larry Bird, as my husband says. It's my Larry Bird year.
What does that mean?
I think it's a sports reference, but your callers can engage with that.
Forgive me for not getting it.
Same. I think it's his jersey number.
Okay. Can you tell me more about your personal history with letter writing? You said you wrote letters as a young kid. Tell me more about that.
There was nothing to write home about that you wrote letters. Everyone, I think that it was very common that we were given pen pals in school. I had a Canadian pen pal. I apologize to her if she's listening. I'm sorry I never wrote you back. That duck box was awesome. And then I proceeded to, you know, if you're attending camps or your friends move away, often letter writing was the main form of communication with them. There was no email quite yet. Eventually there would be instant messaging in my, like, high school years. So that was the only option. Perhaps the show is a lot about nostalgia right now, but I think looking to the future of communication, there's something to be said for having a shoebox full of old letters that have important truths in them versus an email hard drive or something.
Who do you write to when you go to the letter writing club?
I often write to my in-laws and my nieces, people who I don't speak with on the phone as often or engage with who live in my hometown of Lawrence. And those have been the most rewarding people to write to as well, because I know they're going to be part of my life all of my life. It has been decreed by genetics and marriage. So it's nice knowing that we have these multiple avenues to engage with each other. And often they feel more comfortable revealing maybe personal or emotional things in letters, I found. So that's a way to open up different dialogues I feel we wouldn't have if we were sitting at the dinner table with our whole family. It's a private conversation, but
yeah,
it's also removed from time. Yeah, like they can say it and I will hear about it a week later when maybe they're not so emotional. And so they get my response when they perhaps have a more thoughtful response to it.
It's interesting that you should say that because, you know, I don't think that what we get from digital communication is without value. That's in some ways up to us and how we use it. But letter writing is at least different from digital communication, whether we're talking better or worse. To write a letter, you know, you step away from whatever else you're doing and you take time to collect your thoughts and observations and to really consider the other person. And so I think what I miss most about letter writing is just taking time to think.
Absolutely. Do you still write letters, Gina?
I have not done it in a while. I think it takes a really exceptional life moment to make me think, you know, there's something I want to say to someone that I don't want to interrupt normal banter or normal. You know, like you don't want to mm-hmm. take someone maybe to a sad or heavy place or mm-hmm. something like that in real life. So you put it in an envelope and let them be in charge of when they're going to deal with it, kind of.
I agree. We have lots of members who come frequently to Letter Writing Club who have dealt with similar, like, larger life occurrences that they've waited 10 years to respond to a letter or to send a letter to. But I think the benefit of having something like Letter Writing Club, which is frankly just like my own personal checkpoint where I am forced to sit down and write the letter because I have told people that I will responsibly show up once a month on the 10th Sunday of the month at this place. If I didn't carve out that time from my busy schedule, inevitably I would put those things off longer than was necessary or wise. So that opportunity to have people there to support you, basically a support group for letter writing, and then eventually a group to nerd out about the exceptional stamps released by the U.S. Postal Service or whatever might come up.
Who else comes to your letter writing club? I mean, what brings other people there?
I think many of our members were dedicated letter writers their whole life. They never fell off the wagon and had kept pen palships going for 10, 20 years, some of them. So there's certainly those folks who I very much admire, and they've become excellent letter writers as a result of their continuous efforts. And then we also will occasionally have, we have young folks who are 10 and below who come with their parents. And we also have people who were in the coffee shop and unsuspectingly were slipped a piece of stationery who become a letter writer for the day. So it ranges, and it's a very loose affiliation. No one comes every week except a couple of us. And some folks come once, some come frequently.
Who do people write to?
I think many do write to friends and relatives whom they've had correspondence with for many years. But we also have members who are so dedicated to the art of letter writing, they're involved with national organizations and have pen pals given to them through usually online-based matchmaking services, essentially, for letter writers overseas, like Post Crossing and things like that. And we do have a few members who work to write letters to people who are incarcerated or who are otherwise in need of some gentle communication. And people do that as an act of philanthropy, sometimes at Letter Writing Club. We also receive mail at the coffee shop where we meet Decade. So if people want to receive mail not to their home address for any sensitive reason, Letter Writing Club is a way they can have that screen, if you will, if they want to write to strangers.
So the meetings are not actually at Wonder Fair. They're at a coffee shop.
No, I think I spend enough time at Wonder Fair. We're very busy with, we have so many irons in the fire. So this is the organization of the several that we've founded in the projects we keep going where I get off campus, and I like to be out in the community. And I think it's nice because Letter Writing Club is not a money-making endeavor for Wonder Fair. It's one of our community outreach projects. And I think it puts your money where your mouth is if you have the meeting where your money isn't. So we support another local business, Decade, when we do our Letter Writing Club.
It sounds like, I mean, you've talked about like people in the club being really good letter writers. Do people share what they've written?
Initially, when I founded the club, because I enjoy pomp and circumstance and tradition, we would share a letter at the beginning of every club, ceremonially, to open the meeting. We don't do that as often anymore, but folks still will pass around an exceptional letter. For example, we had one member get a really beautifully hand-lettered letter from an older gentleman who she met through a pen pal exchange, and the letter was just so beautiful. Actually, no, it wasn't through a pen pal exchange. He'd found the wrong person's name and address online and sent a letter to her, meaning to send it to someone else of the same name, but happened to find her address through a pen pal exchange. So he wrote to her as though she was a different person, but then they ended up having a correspondence, and he was, and I believe, an art instructor. He had beautiful handwriting, and she shared it with all of us. It was really nice. So Kismet, new friends.
Is there a memorable letter either from your club or from your life that you can tell us about really specifically, like what was in it, what you loved about it?
Well, certainly the letter that started Letter Writing Club, that was a condolence letter about my mother, comes to mind. But I think more recently, a letter that is really important to me that has come to exist because of Letter Writing Club is in writing with my young niece, who is in her teen years. And we all remember our teen years well, I think. She, through our letter writing, has started to open up about how letter writing is helping her get in touch with herself, and that has been nice. But another of my nieces I heard through her, who has mild autism and a lot of difficulty communicating in school, she's below middle school age. She, because she can't communicate with her classmates, has started writing letters to her teacher to talk about it, and her teacher is writing back to her, and that's been really important for her to feel she can be understood in a really loud school environment. And I really like thinking that that might be a tool she's going to be able to use all her life. And apparently in her class, it's catching on to start passing paper notes again in the letter writing way as a result, because the teacher is allowing these notes. So I like to think that they'll be putting their cell phones down a bit more and keeping those notes a little more secret.
The notes that we used to pass in school had, there were like specific kinds of shapes that you would fold them into, and that was part of the fun of it. The football was quite popular.
Totally.
You create a long rectangle, and then you turn that rectangle into a triangle. It's complicated.
It's very complicated. You were advanced. I stopped at heart. Heart fold was easiest.
But as someone who does work in visual arts, and as you were saying, like manipulating things with your hands, can you talk about the physical aspect of letter writing and how that maybe comes into this?
Absolutely. I see it becoming more and more, because we also are a stationery shop in addition to being an art gallery where we do exhibitions. I'm aware of sort of the trends in retail, and I see it becoming more popular for people to invest in higher quality notebook papers where you can pair really nice fountain pens and other kind of writing tools for hand lettering. And I think increasingly people are interested in exploring those simple touch-based art hobbies like we saw happen with adult coloring, I think. And I'm not going to drag adult coloring. I think for many people that was excellent, but maybe letter writing and the art of letter writing on paper and pairing it with exceptional writing tools and fountain pens, that might be an alternative to adult coloring that people use as a mindfulness practice. And it's about touch and sense and mindfully thinking about the letter you're crafting, the things you want to share with the addressee. Think those all go together in a way where on the internet you can shoot off a comment in the heat of the moment, often resulting in a chain of inflammatory remarks that maybe we wish we hadn't engaged in. And that simply doesn't happen in letter writing. You just start a new sheet of paper and they never have to know what you initially put down. So all these things about using your hand, attaching it to your thoughts and your mind, and to the duration of time you spend selecting your tools and your words, that's all been really valuable for me in this fast-paced world.
Do you see it as possible to use digital tools to do some of the things you're talking about? There's something that I think about that when fax machines were big, this is kind of weird, but like I was a teenager in an argument with my dad, and my dad lived in a separate house, and there was a fax machine in the house I lived in, and he sent me a fax.
Wow.
With a drawing on it.
Cool.
And I won't get into the details, but it was supposed to be funny, and that's really not what that tool was meant for. It wasn't meant for, like, dads to send disgruntled teenagers drawings to make them laugh. And I think of that misuse of the tool as kind of, I don't know, it does a lot of what you would do in a letter. There's this visual thing, and I don't know, like, can the letter and everything that's special about it be translated from that physical pen on paper, or is the pen on paper just crucial to what you do there?
I think it can happen, but that we need to be very aware of how often our online content is mediated by advertisers, and when your content is on a platform which is itself a money-making operation, that will inevitably be different than when you're just buying the stamp and perhaps a very fine pad of stationery.
Or even sending a fax.
Or even sending a fax. Bring it back. I'm for it.
Our time is up. Meredith Moore, thanks for stopping by today.
Thank you, Gina. Let's just write letters next time.
Okay.
Okay. We'll post them online.
Meredith hosts a letter writing club in Lawrence on the 10th Sunday of every month. This month's get-together is on June 18th. You can listen back to this discussion and any of our other shows at kcur.org/centralstandard. This week, we talked about changing public education landscape on both sides of the state line. We talked to a Kansas City native who's made a movie about what it means to be Black enough. And we got to know a mechanic from Kansas City's west side who makes lowriders. You can find it all at kcur.org/centralstandard. Central Standard. KCUR Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Tudhope, and Suzanne Hogan. Danielle Hogarty is our intern. Linda Scher runs the board for us, and our music is by Spoonbender Labs. I'm Gina Kaufman. Have a great weekend.